Well, that was a tremendous amount of information to assimilate, and now we're going to get on to your questions. For the first half of this question, I'm going to direct it to you, Jim, and the second half, I'm going to direct it to our industry representatives. Why did the price of oil rise so dramatically over the course of 1 to 2 years and yet fall so quickly by 60% over a very short duration? Was it the fault of producers? Was it the fault of consumers? Or was it the fault of speculators in the market? And the second half, which I will direct to industry, which given the current oil prices and the dramatic decrease in oil prices, and the volatility in the market, are you at the point right now of recommending either the cancellation or at least the delay of any current projects that you have on the drawing board? Or is the emphasis that many countries around the world are placing on alternative and renewable fuels, including nuclear, affecting the decisions and the diversification of your portfolios? Jim, you get to take a crack at the what everybody wants to know.
On the oil price, I think there's a clear answer. It's the 25-year-old hedge fund managers in the world are clearly to blame for everything that's happened. just kidding about that. Just kidding. We could spend a long time talking about the factors that have led to these changes in the oil price, but if you want to look at the root cause of the oil price rise that we saw from 2002 through July of this year, the root cause was rising global prosperity. We've seen one of the most impressive gains in living standards in many parts of the world. Of course, China looms very large in this story. We had the greatest five-year run of global economic growth from 2003 to 2007. Now, that was fueled in part by some of the excesses that we're living with today. But nonetheless, that five-year period saw unprecedented gains in living standards in many countries. And with higher living standards, what do you get? You get longer life expectancy. You get lower infant mortality. And you get rising energy consumption, and oil is certainly a part of that. So higher living standards, greater global prosperity was at the root of the oil price rise that we saw. And there are other factors as well, but that's the foundation. Why have prices fallen so much? Look at the demand side again. In October, in the United States, oil consumption fell by as much as 9%. You look at the stock market, which has fallen 40% or whatever, you may think, oh, gee, that's not very much. But in the oil market world, a 9% drop is massive. There are times when U.S. oil consumption was about 1.8 million barrels per day less than it was a year ago. That is a stunning collapse in demand. Part of that is due to the difficulties of delivering gasoline and other products in the aftermath of Hurricane Ike. So that's a little bit exaggerated, but it does point to the economic weakness that this country is experiencing and that, unfortunately, the rest of the world is too. So we've seen a significant weakening in global oil demand that's become very evident in recent months, and that's one of the factors that's pushed oil prices down so much.
Thanks, Jim. It's a complex question. Jay or Ryan, you want to take crack first at what's happening in corporate decision making as a result of volatility and changing prices?
Well, it's certainly flipped our planning process, I know, in our company on its head. And so as we go into next year, I guess there's a I'd offer two parts to that that question, or a couple of answers or observations. One is that, as we've all described up here, we're talking about mega projects. We're talking about projects that take 5, 6, 7 years to complete. In Nabila's case, they probably will be working 10 years and still have expansions to go. So really the question for us is what is the price of crude and gas and petrochemicals going to be 5, 6, 7, and 10 years from today? So we can't base our company's plans on annual sorts of fluctuations in the price. We have to set ourselves at a midterm, mid-cycle, long-term kind of outlook on commodity prices, and we do that, and we base our plans on that. But we do have to react to the daily vagaries, and the fact that oil West Texas Intermediate over the last week or so has been bouncing down around $60 to $65 a barrel. And that the stark reality of that is it does impact our cash flows and balance sheets of many of the companies that are out there today in this business, some of the independents in the U.S., and even the major IOCs around the world. So we are looking at our plans. We certainly can't afford what we were thinking we could afford even a month ago going into the next couple of years. So we absolutely are looking back at our plans, but again, we try to balance that because we have to take a very long-term view of this business. The reality is this, we'll invest tens of billions of dollars and we won't see a penny in return for 5, 6, 7 out to 10 years. So it's a very capitally intensive business that we're in and a very, very long-term business that we're in. That's why stability and some of the issues that I talked about today are vital in our business. You can't whipsaw this business and change the rules in the middle of the game because there's takes such a long time to develop these projects.
Yeah, I'll just add to a few questions. First of all, I think Jim's dead wrong about the 25-year-old hedge fund trader. But other than that, I think he took care of the oil and gas price pretty well with the supply-demand discussion. I think getting to the budgets and project budgets for IOCs and NOCs, I think you really do need to take a long-term view in this industry. Jim mentioned some demand destruction that happened in 1 month. What I'll say is if you stop investing, the supply can drop as much as 10% a year. And so you can't, as an industry, afford to stop investing. At Chevron, we look at it the long term. Because of the way you set your business up and that sort of thing, you want to try to keep your people sort of busy to a certain level, not overly busy, not underloaded. And so you need to have a view of long-term price, and you need to keep with a capital expenditure profile that is pretty efficient for your company. That's the long-term best way to manage this. I've been with this 30 years, seen a couple of these different cycles. And the last thing you want to do is jerk the wheel of a very large vessel or ship. You've got to be resolute and think it through. But what you do is you're going to suffer some delays in projects. It's really because of the financial ability for your subcontractors and contractors to get the money to buy the materials to supply the services and materials to you. So there is going to be some delay that's naturally associated with the financial crisis and some of the demand destruction, I think. We're just starting to see the beginnings of that. And so that is a bit concerning. You might not be able to deliver exactly what you'd plan to deliver. So we're yet to really analyze that in a lot of detail. There's also going to be alternative energies that come to bear. Our company, for instance, is very interested in alternative energy. We are the largest geothermal power producer in the world. What we think is important is, first of all, if you want to help, conserve. I'm an engineer. The first thing you think about is if you want to really think about demand, Jim mentioned it, in 1 month, just because people quit going out, the demand dropped by 9%. So conservation is a very, very important alternative. That's the piece I think that's very important. But I think keeping the long-term view, keeping the ship going steady is the path that we should take through a lot of these ups and downs.
Nabila, let me turn to you, and just the question for you is a little bit more complex. As a country and as a company that is a huge and important producer, but also a growing consumer, you have to look at this from multiple angles. And at the same time, you have to be able to calculate what countries like ourselves and others are going to be doing and what their policies will be on alternatives to oil and natural gas. So as you think, as you're looking at that as a corporation, how does that confound decision-making right now?
I think, just like the gentleman said, it is very important in our business to work collaboratively, to look, and we are part of the companies that are encouraging and participate in other alternative energies, in energy conservation, because of the growing demand of energy around the world. So it does provide additional opportunities for our company and our nation to be part of the global world to assess what other things could we be doing, because we are participant, not just a providers of energy, but as you mentioned, consumers, and every technology that is out there that could help, whether in production or in alternative energy or clean energy, we are part of that process.
Fair enough. We are certainly here in the United States very captivated right now by our election campaign, and there are a number of questions up here that deal with that, so I'm going to combine them into one and ask each of the panelists to give their thoughts. Forgive me if I go on for just a minute to tell you where these questions are going. But first, what are the key challenges for the oil and gas industry under the next president? And then play the other side of it is, you know, what should the next president do to stabilize, to use your words, the oil markets? And how should that affect, and Nabila, this one will be good for you, the foreign policy employed by the next president and Congress to a lesser extent? And looking at the two presidential candidates who have articulated very aggressive goals for greenhouse gas reduction, Senator McCain at 60% and Senator McCain at 80%, are either of those goals or objectives achievable over the time frame that they have articulated? So what are the challenges that you're going to have under the next president? What should the next president be doing? What does that mean about foreign policy? And what does that mean for climate legislation and climate policy? I knew I'd have no takers. We can go alphabetically, or Ryan's the first volunteer.
I'll jump in.
I'll go last, since I'm not a U.S. citizen.
It's like, come on in, the water is fine, right? So key challenges for the next president. I believe personally, when you juxtapose foreign policy, energy policy, and climate policy, I don't think there's anything more important right now for both the United States and the world, because they're all so interrelated. And I think for the next president, we think we've had an energy policy as a company or as a country, but we really haven't. And I think to the hard truths from the NPC study were really good. And at the risk of sort of repeating what Jim said here earlier, it's going to take everything. And I think the next president has to seriously look at that. We have to take wind where wind is popular where wind can really help in the central part of the U.S. We have to invest in solar. We have to invest in biofuels and some of the, whether it's corn-based ethanol or cellulosic or another generation, algae, lipids, whatever it may be on the biofuel side. And we need oil and gas. We need conventional oil and gas. We need unconventional. We need tight, deep gas. We need sour gas. We need heavy oil. We need all those things in a very balanced and very forward-looking policy that then can create energy security for our country. I don't think, my personal belief is energy independence, as they came up with in the NPC study, is not the right tack to be taken. You want to be dependent in the world. You want to be part of this global economy. And I think that's the challenge of the next president, is how to create the incentives to start innovation amongst the alternative fuels. Maybe you have to subsidize them for a little while, but don't subsidize them forever. Let the market decide what's going to be successful and unsuccessful down the road, but we have to jumpstart all the alternatives. And we can't forget about oil and gas. So that we have to have an effective foreign policy. We can't isolate ourselves, because the sheer fact of the matter is we consume 25% of the world's energy. We produce as a country less than 4% of the world's energy. So to isolate ourselves is the absolute wrong answer in our effort to become more secure as a nation and understand what it means to play in the energy landscape around the world. And so I don't think there's anything more important. When you juxtapose foreign policy on energy policy, then you have to consider the greenhouse gas policy. You have to consider, as a world, what are we going to do with CO2? When we look at CO2 and we try to address it as a company, it is going to be very expensive. We have to come up with global solutions for it, and the consumer is going to have to see the cost that it means to deal with CO2 as a nation and as a world, because we're going to have to make those hard decisions, and it is going to add cost to the global energy system when you consider what do you want to do with CO2 and how do you create clean technologies, which is an absolute must, because our human activity is having an impact on the world, and I think that is undisputable in this day and age. We're having an impact. We're going to have to deal with it, and we're going to have to deal with it in a very worldly, comprehensive fashion.
Jay, as you take a crack at this question, as the business development guy at Chevron, also, if you could send a message to the next president about things to be careful of for the oil and gas industry, what things are you, what challenges do you see for your industry under whomever comes next, in addition to the other questions we asked?
I think in my remarks, I tried to link foreign policy and energy policy very closely together. And what I'll say from a BD space or a deal flow space is there's a lot of barriers to entry. And the more of those you can take down or neutralize, the better opportunity you have. If you one, don't have a policy, or two, you have a policy that makes it very hard for you to enter certain places, the scope of your opportunity set gets to be so small, it doesn't give you much access to new energy or new solutions to energy. As Ryan was saying, I think we need a lot of different opportunities. We need everything. We need alternatives. We need, from solar to wind. We need different nuclear opportunities. We need to conserve. We need that by 2030, if we're right, unless everybody just decides to change their quality of life by a lot, we're gonna need these sources. As China grows, many of you that travel to China, once they've started growing, they don't want to stop either. So that's a factor that we haven't really taken into account. There's going to be different opportunities that we don't know today. When I started 30 years ago, there was no such thing as a horizontal well. But yet a horizontal well delivers 5 times the gas in the tight gas sands in the U.S. that a vertical well delivered when I started with the industry. So what used to be uneconomic is now economic, and it's not just price. It's because of the research dollars that were spent and the people's effort to get us to where we are. So I'm a firm believer that technology will play a big role in the future in our ability to cope with these challenges. Greenhouse gas, I think, is also a very important attribute. The key is to greenhouse gas sequestration is try to sequester the places that have the highest concentration. Because as those point sources get spread out, it's very, very expensive to gather them up to one spot to be able to do something about it. So we have to work collaboratively, because it may be we use 25% of the energy here. There may be we can only sequester 10 or 15. It may be the Middle East that has an easier solution to sequester a lot more. So we have to be careful that we don't regulate in such a way that it makes those type global opportunities impossible.
Thank you. Nabila, as you take on the question about foreign policy and what type of a foreign policy should our next president employ to ensure we have the cooperation necessary to sustain our relationship on an energy basis. Also, help us understand, now that Saudi Arabia is a member of the WTO, what that means in terms of how energy deals are being done inside the kingdom on the downstream.
One project that I mentioned, the RTEP project, is an example of that collaboration between major companies to basically take advantage of the hydrocarbon resources that we have and leverage those to invest in the downstream and value-added projects. And that's just an example of our commitment to really, not in the petrochemicals, but also in the availing of our hydrocarbon resources to the ensuring the stability of the world market. I have been personally involved in many of our projects that we have invested to increase the level of production, and we always ensure that there is a minimum of 1.5 to 2 million barrels of spare capacity to ensure that we are able to stabilize the world market in oil. That a lot of people don't realize how much investment that takes in hundreds of millions of dollars to ensure stability of availability of crude oil, as well as to stabilize pricing. I think that our records shows that we are committed to the availability of such an important resource, and we have been reliable. And I think in today's global market and the recent financial crisis indicates that we have become so global, and the collaboration between not only companies but also nations is very crucial as many nations industrialize and the demand of commodities and resources really impact all of us. We saw that the demand of iron ore made the Brazilian increase the cost and the price of that, and that impacted the cost of steel and other commodities around the world. That's how global the world have become. So each of us is contribute an important element, and as such, we really need to be an important citizens of the world.
Thank you for that. I'm going to ask one more general question of the panel, and then at the chair's elective, I'm going to ask one closing question of my own that will only require a one-sentence answer by each of you so that we can keep on time for the reception that's to follow this. If we look at the language that people that are running for higher office and in Congress in our country, over the last several years, it started with security, energy realism. We then moved into energy independence. And now we are seeing a great deal of policymakers out on the campaign trail utilize words like we need to get off foreign oil, specifically we need to stop using oil from the Middle East. And the mantra has gotten bigger and louder and wider, and you know, that is to a very big and broad audience. So let me just say, it's a very sensitive subject, I know that, but we're here in terms of the title of the conference, Transitioning to the Next President and Strengthening the Relationships Between U.S. and Arab Policymakers. What do we do about that, quote-unquote, hard truth that could be included in the National Petroleum Council's report? That is a hard truth. What do we do about changing that tenor? How do we go about changing that dialogue, and how do we go about bringing a little bit more realism into what needs and can be accomplished in increasing our mutual energy security?
Your turn.
Well, one basic step, I think, is to attempt to increase Americans' energy literacy. I think one reason why a lot of these slogans. I mean, President Nixon talked about energy independence in the early 70s. Every president has, and at the U.S. dependence on global markets has only grown during that time, as has the U.S. economy. So I think getting people, the American people are not stupid people at all. I'm not implying that, but trying to educate them about the realities of how large the global energy system is, how important certain fuels are, and the long lead times that are necessary to undertake any long-term change. So energy literacy may sound very simple, but it could have a powerful impact.
Anybody else?
Well, I think that's right. We don't do a very good job as an industry of telling our story, and it's a highly competitive business, so that creates a little bit of issues in and of itself. Karen, you quoted some of the statistics earlier. I think I take a little bit of comfort in the fact that 2 years ago our public opinion was less than tobacco. So we've risen at least above back above tobacco as an industry with the American people. So I think we are making some headroads, and just the sheer fact that politicians today are talking about it, and I think realizing that there is there's a relationship between the energy policy, foreign policy, and maybe even your environmental policy. They're all so interrelated that you have to start having these conversations today. I know when I talk to my family who don't understand as a lot, too, they don't really realize the business. And the story I tell, if you bear with me for just 1 second, is you think about the reliability of the energy business today. So we drill a bunch of wells, we produce the oil, we separate the water and the gas, we send it to a facility, it gets piped or shipped to a refinery, the refinery cracks the oil, turns it into petrochemicals, turns it into diesel and gasoline, again gets piped and trucked over to facilities where trucks come and pick it up, take it to a gasoline station where you buy gasoline for your car. So think about the reliability of that supply chain. If it had the reliability of this piece of equipment here today, you would be paying two or three times what you pay for gasoline today, because we can't afford to go into a room in the house where I don't get cell phone coverage. Can't afford to go through a tunnel when my cell phone doesn't work. I can't afford to go around that mountain or be up by that mountain area when my cell phone doesn't work. So we consider that's the education that we need to do. It's these long supply chains. It's our interdependence globally with the Middle East, with everywhere around the world. That's what it takes in this business today. And it's long lead times, hugely capital intensive. And we can't afford the reliability of something like this to make it work.
Nabila, would you like to add anything to that?
No, I think it was well said. But I hope it's only rhetoric.
Before I ask my final closing question, which will require just a one- or two-sentence answer, let me just say that we have the Institute of which I'm a part has tried to capture the challenges that we've just articulated here and are trying to inform policymakers about the challenges and opportunities of our energy policy, and have released 75 policy recommendations for the next president and Congress to consider. And soon after the election is over and the votes are counted, we'll be releasing a transition plan on how to actually execute and implement those policy recommendations and in what time period they need to be done. So hopefully we'll have some rational things out there for our policymakers to consider. They're very constructive and hopefully to adopt. Let me close by asking a question, which is just taking the title of what this important conference is Transitioning the White House, Challenges and Opportunities for Arab-U.S. Relations. In each of your perspectives, what is the single most important thing the leadership in the United States and the leadership in the Arab world can do in the next year to improve our relationships to the benefit of the energy markets? That's a hard one.
I'll take that first.
That's a very hard one.
I think it's a very simple principle that very, very much associates with a lot of life. We have to develop mutual respect for each other and a deep understanding about the drivers of each other and a cooperation that will go beyond whoever's elected or whatever government's in place. That it's more a people-to-people understanding. And I think those are the type of relationships and understanding that are important. Because, as has been mentioned, certain rhetoric inflames a lot of people. And some of it's for very nationalistic reasons. But at a business level, you have to develop relationships and trust that will allow you to work through the hard times, that you don't just exit because you think something's getting tough, or you don't quit producing because the price gets too low. You have to think about it as a very long-term venture, very much like a marriage. So, thank you.
Commitment and durability.
That's right.
Jim, anything?
One thing I would say is to enhance global cooperation in institutions. Global institutions are a way to prevent, manage, or ideally even resolve conflicts. And given how connected we all are, I think global institutions, and I'm not advocating global government, let's be clear about that, but institutions which provide a forum to prevent, manage, or resolve conflicts. Bringing China and India into the International Energy Agency would be one example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree, Karen. I think it's been said. I think business has a unique opportunity. We can work together with partners all around the world, and if we can create a sustainable business model, we can persevere through the commodity cycles and through the vagaries of Washington, D.C.
I mean, because certainly it is the private sector that will ultimately lead us to increased energy security, and government has a role to play for sure in facilitating the right environment for that investment and that technology to thrive. But they're only a part of the equation. I mean, the folks that are sitting up here on the dais are really the people that can manifest the opportunities and manifest the capital to make these things really happen. Well, with your indulgence, I suppose that we should call it quits for the day. It looks like everybody has put in a good day's work and are anxious to get on to your very gracious reception. Let me just say that energy security is one of our nation's certainly biggest challenges for the 21st century. It is not an economic challenge. It is not a national security challenge. It is not an environmental challenge. It is not a prosperity challenge. It is not a home and well-being challenge. It is all of the above. And we have to approach it like that. We have to have a comprehensive approach, and it cannot be inside of our 50 states. It has to be global in nature. And we have to look at the realities over the horizon that we are going to be dependent on fossil fuels for decades to come. And we do need alternatives, and we do need to diversify. And certainly we're seeing that in the Arab world as many investments are being made in alternative renewable fuels in the Middle East and certainly here in this country. So we can march along this very difficult road together if we seize the opportunity wisely. Thank you.
Thank you.